Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Written into the Constitution of the Eurozone is that really only banks should create credit and create it at interest. The governments should not provide money to the economy. Government should raise their money by selling off their public domain to private investors. The governments should not provide social services, should not provide infrastructure services, that all of these should be privatized, and that means building into their price structure interest charges, exorbitant salaries, and economic rent for whatever the privatizers can charge.
And therein lies the problem of our reliance on private banks for issuance of our money the world over. That's our notable guest, Dr. Michael Hudson, who is our featured guest today with Ellen. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree. Today, we'll be hearing more definitive insight into the foundational problems with our monetary system that is clearly failing to keep its end of the bargain of extending credit and financial liquidity into the economies of nations and peoples the world over. Whether you look at Detroit, Puerto Rico, or a host of other troubled economies, the same players are behind the destruction of local economies for the sake of private investor and gambler profits. And we'll also examine a more central aspect of the situation, the need for broadly distributed financial liquidity for everyone if the system is going to work. And that's where we're going to start off today in our conversation with Ellen, who has just completed a book on the future of banking in the 21st century. The idea of a distributed credit network, even a personal crediting system, in which you bank based on your unique registered identity. This has been emerging along with the realization that money is credit and accounting, not tangible stuff like gold, silver, and beads. Ellen is preparing for a presentation on this new frontier of cryptocurrencies and has some expansive new notions to talk about. We caught up to her as she was visiting in Switzerland.
We've made it through the summer. Now the things are starting to get very serious all around the world, it seems, and currency is a very hot topic. So much has changed. India has pulled cash off the streets in a surprise move, and everybody's suddenly talking about cryptocurrencies. I, of course, figured that that's a result of you and I doing the special shows about that a couple of months ago, but, you know.
Right.
But then there's, so what's going on from your perspective about all this?
Well, I'm actually writing on the subject, and I've just finished a book called The Coming Revolution in Banking, The Democratization of Finance in the Digital Age. And after writing the whole thing, the whole second half was basically on how to turn how to create a national public banking system on a blockchain or on a digital thing in which we, the people, actually become our own bankers, where we create our own money. So the first half is about how banks are not simply intermediaries lending on the money of their depositors. They actually create money when they make loans, and that's the basis of our money supply. So it's basically a credit system, rather like a mutual credit system, which is a community currency, where the people create the money themselves when they enter into some sort of a transaction. So you've got a credit on one side and a debit on the other side. So it's a bookkeeping thing. And it's the same with banks, where they create money through double-entry bookkeeping, where they write your promise to repay on one side as an asset to themselves, and then they write their liability on the other side as a liability to themselves, so the books balance, and that's how they create money. So I've already submitted my draft to the editor, which is at Democracy Collaborative, and I discovered after doing a lot of research that blockchain actually won't work for if you tried to do that as a national currency. It wouldn't work because it's just too big. I mean, there are too many transactions to put into one ledger that everybody shares so that every time you have some sort of transaction, it has to change the whole ledger across the country. They're just already Bitcoin has gotten so slow that people are complaining about it that it could take up to an hour for a transaction. I mean, you don't want to be standing in the grocery line for an hour waiting for your transaction to clear, and it's getting more expensive because now there are fees attached to trying to get it a little faster. So if you had to pay $5 every time you went to the grocery store, you wouldn't do it. But you don't, as it turns out, you don't need blockchain for a mutual credit system. And so Bitcoin is, this is my recent thinking that I just realized this morning, but this is sort of an impromptu little interview. I'm in Switzerland at the moment. What I just realized this morning is you don't need blockchain for a mutual credit system, which is what our national currency is. A blockchain is where you assume Austrian economics. So you assume that money is a thing like gold that you have to borrow from somewhere else, or you have to buy it or borrow it. So that's what Bitcoin's based on, and that's why Bitcoin requires a blockchain. So you need this chain of title to show that it wasn't duplicated, that two people didn't spend it at the same time. So this is a digital currency created out of nothing. It's basically a fiat currency. So you have to go through this complicated mining process to make it so that people can't just create it willy-nilly. And it's a thing. It's like gold, and so you need to trace it, and that's why you need the blockchain. But if you're doing a mutual credit system, you can do all you need to keep track of is that individual trade, like the credit and the debit. And you could do that in a cell phone. You could just keep track of your own trades. So the idea would be to have an algorithm that is capable of determining your creditworthiness without the bank. So we now know that you send your data to the bank, and then the bank just determines if you're creditworthy, and then they give you a loan. So they turn your own credit into money. But you can now do that with an algorithm, or with a computer program, and you don't need a bank or middleman. And they're already doing it in India. They actually are giving loans in 5 minutes, microloans, on cell phones. They've set up this very complicated digital system. This is really an interesting subject, but I don't know if I have time to go into it. What we've heard about India is they did this demonetization, and it was a horrible thing, and it's the New World Order and the one world currency and all these, and they took away people's cash, and that, how horrible of them to do this. But in fact, what they've done is, I would argue that probably wasn't necessary. It's probably too much, too fast, a radical move, but what it did do is it's basically turning everyone digital. Up till now, only 2% or 3% of the population was paying taxes. Everything was in cash, and people did, up till just a few years ago, people didn't even have IDs, so they couldn't even get a bank account, and they didn't have IDs because they weren't born in a hospital, and there was no record of their birth. But now they've gone through these various steps. The first step was to give everybody an ID card. I think there are 1.2 billion people in India. 1.1 billion have been put on this system where they got an ID card based on their fingerprint and their eye scan. So just, recognizing who they are. So now they know who you are, and you can use smart contracts to bake into this program your whole credit history, whether you paid your bills, et cetera. And so it's just like when they give you a credit card based on your credit history, and you use your credit card instantly. Nobody checks to determine whether you paid your bill last month, et cetera. Whether you paid your utility bill or something. They don't check all those details. It's just all automatic that you get the credit with the credit card. Well, you can now get a loan. A small business can get a loan for $500 or something in 5 minutes just using their cell phone And it's not using a blockchain. It's just, it's cryptocurrency because it's all encrypted, and you've got all this data encrypted in the the code. But anyway, so anyway, it's quite exciting what the possibilities are, and I'll be speaking at a conference in Aspen on September 21st to 23rd. On it's the Nexus conference, which is on cryptocurrencies. So that's why I'm busily preparing all this.
Wow. That's quite a brain full of concept and developments. Ability to control the currency in a country, though, is that sovereign right, isn't it? I mean, it's the ability to keep everybody reporting and paying into the common fund and the common national treasury. Well, does this not eliminate that? I'm just wondering if a mutual credit system would eliminate the centralization of the sovereign currency for a nation.
Well, if it's a mutual credit system, right now we have mutual credit systems, which are community currencies. That's what community currencies are. But they're too limited. So you're not going to get your phone company or your utility company to accept payment with your local community currency. Mm-hmm. And then you have the problem of accepting one community currency even by another community, that even if they all trade in community currencies, you have a problem of making them sort of fungible. But if you did it as a national currency, where everybody, where the government did have a record of who you are and how to find you, then they would be able to tax you. And that is one reason that India did this radical thing that they did. But it's actually, they've been working on opening up credit to everyone ever since 1969, when Indira Gandhi nationalized 14 big banks, not because they were bankrupt, but just because the country, that the poor people needed credit. So she said, well, they're not servicing the poor people, so we're going to have to nationalize them, which is really radical if you think about it. It'd be like nationalizing 14 Wall Street banks and saying, you need to serve the poor and you're not doing it, so we're taking you over. And they've been working on that ever since. They have a more desperate situation than we did. They had this massive famine right before they got became a country, when they broke free from England and or the UK. So, you know, they've got to keep these people alive. So they have to take more radical measures. I mean, they've got the political will, whereas we could do it, but we don't have the political will. I mean, that's the problem that we're always up against, is we can't get these politicians to change. They like all that money they get from the big banks, and why should they change the system?
Yeah.
It seems to me the way to make
franchise. I'm sorry.
Yeah. The way to make it fungible across the whole field, to make everybody accept it, is make it the U.S. dollar. That is what our U.S. dollar is, and that would be what the Indian rupee would be, et cetera. It's a digital currency. But with smart contracts and with the system the Indians have set up, you get to control what information other people see. It's not like all your records are out there in open view. If you want a loan, you'd be submitting certain stuff. You could keep your medical records on that. You could keep all kinds of records. So you have your own private database with all your stuff on it that you can tap into as needed for various uses. But you have control. And really, when you are taking out a loan, you are not borrowing somebody else's money. You are turning your own promise to pay or your own future ability to pay into money now that you can now spend, which you need to run a national economy or any kind of economy. You've got to have credit. You've got to be able to pay your workers and materials before you have a product to sell, and that's what credit is, and that's what our money system is. So gold has never worked for that reason. It's too limited, and Bitcoin wouldn't work as a national currency, not only because it's Austrian-based, like a thing in limited supply, but also because it's just the whole blockchain thing is too slow and congested for massive transactions.
Yeah. Now, is this a system, the kind of a system that might be able to be deployed in emergency situations like we have with Harvey and some of the other disasters, where there's a huge amount of need for cash and the banks aren't able to fill it and the Congress is going to be slow? Might this be a system that could be deployed for a focused market, so to speak?
Yeah, it seems like you could certainly let governments, local governments, turn their future promise to pay into money. They've got a record right there that they're a good pay. They've been paid solidly, so give them the credit and let them spend the money and pay it back however they do, or even not pay it back. I mean, you can do quantitative easing for the people.
Yeah, the scaling of that or the ability to localize that around the local promise to pay might be useful in extending credit for yourself for infrastructure development, no?
Yeah.
So in some ways, certainly a complementary idea to having a public bank, extending credit out of your own creditworthiness, but through a different form. I see, though, that China has forbidden cryptocurrencies at this point for fear of the lack of the transparency transactions for money laundering.
Well, they forbade ICOs, which are initial coin offerings. I don't know that they've forbidden. I don't think they've forbidden the cryptocurrencies. They're the big holders of Bitcoin. They'd have a mutiny in their hands. You know, millions of dollars have gone to these ICOs, which are totally unregulated. It's where they raise money it looks like a security, but they say it's not a security. But now I guess our SEC has said it is a security, and I think that's why China got all nervous about it, because, you know, we're saying we're going to regulate it.
Well, all of these changes kind of make me think maybe we need to change the name of our show from It's Our Money to It's Our Credit.
Good idea.
There
well, and it's still a public banking system. I mean, you still need, like, local banks as civil servants doing their job, you know, doing all those things. You can't get a computer program to do everything, but it would make it much faster, more efficient, and you can cut out their ability to manipulate and play favorites and so forth. The program would be the same for everybody. Anybody who qualified would get that type of loan at that interest rate. Like students, you know, you might have one interest rate for them because you've got to cover defaults. So maybe there's a higher default rate, so you're going to have a higher interest rate for students.
Yeah.
But it's still going to be way lower than what they would get now with all the cuts that go to the private investors.
Well, it's really hard to keep the brain up to speed with all of the changes that are going on. And, you know, we started out thinking about money as only as this commodity, or people normally have been thinking that way. And now you, of course, have expanded our thinking into realizing that it's a credit debit accounting scheme. And now it's morphing into something that has no bearing to anything real other than agreements and algorithms. And it's quite an interesting transition we live in at the moment.
But I think it's better. I mean, it's liquidity. It's how it's trade. It actually the original money system back in Sumeria was a credit system. I mean, it was just keeping track of who owed what to whom, and that's going back to it. You don't have to have this outside thing that you have to get, and that some people are able to make scarce, so that you have to pay a lot of money for it, and they can withdraw it at any time. It's a thing you generate from within yourself, so that's much gives us all individual sovereignty.
That's terrific. I mean, it's a very mind-blowing realization that we're at that point. And thank you so much for bringing it to us, Ellen. I'm looking forward to your revised visions to your book, recently completed book, for the next system project. But that's how, one step at a time. And we'll see what happens next.
Okay, thanks. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Ellen. Thanks. Bye-bye.
The preceding discussion with Ellen just occurred, but now we're going to replay a germane discussion that we had last year with Michael Hudson, which speaks to the nature of our monetary and banking system. You might recall that Michael Hudson was advising the Greek government during their monetary crisis. That crisis characterizes in our own monetary crisis, because we still have to overcome the monopoly on money creation, which is at the heart of our problems. Here's their conversation from 2016.
It is my great honor and pleasure to be speaking with Michael Hudson, a Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of a number of excellent books, most recently, The Bubble and Beyond. Michael has advised governments worldwide on finance and tax law, including Iceland, Latvia, China, and now Greece. Greetings, Michael. It's so great to be talking to you.
Good to be here. I wasn't a formal advisor. I just went to a meeting of the Left Syriza group in Delphi and became part of the Delphi overall advisory group, but that wasn't officially with the government at all.
Mm-hmm. So can you just tell us in a nutshell what you see as the problem and whether there's any hope for Greece getting out of it?
Well, the problem is the Eurozone, which is basically a dead zone following austerity. The Eurozone really doesn't have a central bank that does what central banks are supposed to do, which is finance government deficit spending into the economy. The way an economy gets money and credit basically is for the governments to run a deficit and spend it into it. Any dollar bills or currency that you have in your pocket is a result of government spending. If the government didn't have any money to spend, there wouldn't be any. And after the Civil War in America, when the industrial North took over and raised tariffs, the government ran such a large surplus that it sucked money out of the economy, deflated the economy, and brought over a decade of deflation. The same thing happened after 1836 and 37 when Andrew Jackson closed the Second Bank of the United States. That led to the crash of 1837. So Europe is essentially following a guaranteed crash. It says the basic principle written into the Constitution of the Eurozone is that really only banks should create credit and create it at interest. The governments should not provide money to the economy. Government should raise their money by selling off their public domain to private investors. The government should not provide social services, should not provide infrastructure services, that all of these should be privatized, and that means building into their price structure interest charges, exorbitant salaries, and economic rent for whatever the privatizers can charge. So the double-edged sword of being a member of the Eurozone is, number one, you don't have government credit to the economy. You don't have deficit spending. That's limited to 3% of GDP. You don't even have Keynesian recovery from a depression. You have to privatize and become a high-cost society. And unless you're Germany, your population has to be cut by 30%. Your wages have to be cut by about 40%. And they all have to emigrate to somewhere else, like Germany. Or wherever they can find work. And this is just a total disaster. That's what Greece found itself in and what it tried to get out of when it voted for the Syriza party. And when the Syriza people came in January, they thought, well, maybe we can reason with them. But what they didn't realize is that their economist, Yanis Varoufakis, was not talking to other economists. He wasn't talking to reasonable people. He was talking to lawyers. And the lawyers said, here are the rules. You got to follow them. The rules are written into the Constitution. You have to make an even a deeper depression. And Varoufakis and Tsipras, the prime minister, said, wait a minute. We've just had an election. The people have decided they don't want more austerity. They want to regrow, and we have a plan for regrowing. And they were told, the fact that you had an election means absolutely nothing. Elections don't change things. We already have the rules. It doesn't matter what democracy is. The Eurozone is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship by the banks. Banks are not elected. Voters don't have a role to play in that. If you join the Eurozone, forget what the voters say. Forget democracy. You're going to do what the banks say, and we're in it to make money for ourselves and for our clients. We're going to lend our clients enough money to buy your banks, your islands, your ports, any public utilities you have, your gas rights, and we're going to bankrupt you a little bit more. We're going to shrink you to such a low level that we can lend our clients money to buy your privatized land and enterprises very cheaply. And needless to say, Varoufakis said, well, maybe we can talk you out of it. And he spent about 6 months trying to talk them out of it, and then he realized he was getting absolutely nowhere, that they weren't in a talkative mood. And so finally they had a referendum, and by that time the Greek population got so angry, basically, at the Germans and at being told what to do, that they voted a very definite no. Well, at this point, there was an argument within the Syriza party. Varoufakis and the economic part of the left didn't want to pay the debt. They were prepared to go it alone and essentially be kicked out of the Eurozone. But the Greek politicians were afraid of this. They thought that this would be result in an even worse crash than was being engineered by the Germans, and overruled Varoufakis. So he resigned, and most of the left wing of the Syriza people resigned, and that's the state of affairs we're in right now. It's sort of in a no man's land, whereas Greece is still being told to privatize. It's refusing to privatize. It's being told to cut back pensions anymore. It's refused to do that. It's being told to raise the value-added tax to 23%, which is a very high tax. Imagine having to go to the store if you're an American and pay a 23% sales tax. You know, absolutely crazy. And what Tsipras and Varoufakis said was, look, we're willing to create more taxes, but what we want to do is to tax the wealthy tax evaders. And the Europeans got furious. They threw them out of the room. Now, you can't tax the rich. The rich are our clients. You can't tax the tax evaders because they're putting all their money in our banks. If you tax them, they won't have enough money to put in our banks as flight capital. So, I mean, it's a bizarre state of affairs, and the only positive thing to come out of it is that Spain and Portugal and Italy have now seen how poisonous the Eurozone really is.
So how can they get out of it? I guess Varoufakis had attempted to set up an alternative payment system just in case they had to leave the euro.
Yes.
Or leave.
Well, they had two suggestions as an emergency response. The first suggestion wasn't withdrawing from the euro. It's that Greece doesn't really have a central bank. What is called the Greek central bank works for the European central bank, and its job is to bankrupt the Greek banks, not to support them. Its job was to pull the plug and create an artificial crisis where everybody had to go to the ATM machines by depriving the banks of liquidity. So what's needed is a real central bank, or what used to be in America the treasury, and what in most countries is the treasury. Varoufakis wanted to create treasury promissory notes that could be used for paying taxes. This is basically the state theory of money, that the government would simply spend its own money denominated in euros into the economy, and that would fuel the economy. At the same time, the plan was, now that the European Central Bank in Europe was not supporting the Greek banks at all, just stop paying the foreign debt. The parliament there had a large meeting on odious debt, called the Debt Truth Commission, and they found good reasons not to pay Greece's foreign debt to the IMF or the European Commission or the European Central Bank, all called the Troika, because back in 2011 and 12, when the International Monetary Fund agreed to join the Troika, the IMF staff economists themselves said, we can't make this loan under IMF rules. Greece can't pay the current debt. It would be a disaster to make the loan because the loan's going to go bad almost immediately. And unfortunately, the head of the IMF was in a total conflict of interest. That was Dominique Strauss-Kahn. And Strauss-Kahn, at the time, the IMF had hardly any customers in the world. Just about every country in the world wanted to be as far away from the IMF as they could be, because the IMF's medicine for everything is cause austerity, cut your labor costs 30%, and support the banking system, and essentially representing the 1% against the 99%. Well, Strauss-Kahn wanted to run as president for France, and the largest group of bondholders of Greek bonds were the French banks. So Sarkozy in France said, look, you've got to support the French banks. You can't expect to run for president and then pull the plug on the French banks. And also, the European Central Bank said, wait a minute, if you want to be part of the Troika, if you want to join us in this, you have to support our hard line. If you say that the Greeks can't pay, that's not what we say. We say any country can pay any sum of foreign debt if only it lowers wages by enough. So all we have to do is lower wages by enough. You know, and if Greece can't pay, fine, we'll just make it sell all the property, the islands, the gas rates, and everything else. So the price of the IMF joining with the European Central Bank and the European Commission was to violate its articles of agreement that say that the IMF can only make a loan to a country with a reasonable ability to pay, defined as being able to turn this debt over to the private markets. Well, no private market was going to buy Greek bonds because the private markets at that time were pricing Greek bonds at only one-third of the face value, meaning that they knew that Greece couldn't pay. So somehow Greece made this loan. The current Greek Debt Truth Commission said, wait a minute, there should be a basic rule that if a government organization or any creditor makes a loan to a debtor, knowing in advance that the debtor can't pay and the intention is to foreclose, that's an odious debt. That debt is just leverage to grab property, and it doesn't have to be paid. We're a sovereign government. The Greek prime minister at that time, Papandreou, wanted to hold a referendum, and Angela Merkel said, you can't hold a referendum. They're going to vote against it, and removed the Prime Minister Papandreou in favor of a central banker, the same central banker who had worked with Goldman Sachs to falsify Greece's foreign debt in 2001 when it originally faked its statistics to be able to join the Eurozone. So the whole financial situation of Greece was a put-up job. And there's a good argument for throwing it into the courts, which would probably take 10 years, maybe 20 years to settle. And in the meanwhile, Greece wouldn't have many problems at all once it doesn't have to pay the Troika, the intergovernment organizations that took over the debt. Its payments would be in a pretty good state. It wouldn't have to devalue. It would be okay.
So they can go to, have they gone to court? And
no.
That's an automatic stay on whether they
No, they haven't gone to court, and they haven't made the claim, and they're still paying the debt. And all the money that they're borrowing from Europe is simply to pay back Europe. So it's purely a bookkeeping mm-hmm. operation. Money is lent to Greece. It's paid right back. So in effect, Greece's debt is expanding at a compound interest exponentially. Any compound interest is a doubling time, as we've spoken about before. And it hasn't really tried to make any use of resist these demands for austerity.
Why haven't they gone to court, though? They did the Truth Commission, and they
because they think that this would make Europe angry, and they don't want to make Europe angry.
Mm.
They want to win a they think that somehow they can convince, they can talk reason to Europe. And it's like if you're a debtor and you owe the bank money and you go to the bank and say, wait a minute, I really can't pay, you know, my sister's sick or whatever, and I have, you know, can't you be reasonable? And the bank will say, I'm sorry, we can't be reasonable. You owe us the money. You know, we're going to have to foreclose on your house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a asymmetrical situation there.
So how would they get out? Should they go to the drachma, or is that not a feasible?
They don't have to go to the drachma. All they have to do is stop paying the debts. They should be prepared to say, look, if you we're not going to withdraw from the Eurozone. I don't even know how they do that legally. If you want to kick us out of the Eurozone, that's fine, but we're going to print Euro-denominated IOUs, and we're going to continue to use the Euro. And the problem is that the European Central Bank then would say, okay, we're not going to support the Greek banks anymore. Well, one of the things that we discussed in Delphi was that the banks in Greece are owned by the oligarchs, and the European banks are very predatory. They're trying to buy the Greek banks. So we thought, well, wait, it's not a bad thing if the banks are broke and the European Central Bank drives the Greek banks under, then you've just destroyed the oligarchs' means of controlling the economy. So the government can take them over, just like the U.S. government could have taken over Citibank, or just like the FDIC took over Washington Mutual and Continental Illinois. And the government could have taken them over and run these Greek banks all of a sudden as a public option. in the public interest. And instead of the banks being used by the oligarchs as flight capital to get their money out of Greece, the banks could have been used to actually finance Greek business and the domestic Greek economy and helped the Greek economy grow instead of shrink.
Mm-hmm. It is kind of hard to, I totally agree with that. I mean, the public option is definitely where they should go or should have gone long ago. But it is hard to envision how they're going to use euros that they print. I mean, what if every country printed
they wouldn't print
its own
the euro
euros?
Notes.
Doesn't that dilute the...
They wouldn't print the euro notes. They would print IOUs denominated in dollars. Now, you and I cannot print dollar bills. But we can write IOUs that are denominated in dollars. I can write something, you know, I can write a bond saying I owe Ellen Brown $1,000, and you can, you know, trade this. It's denominated in dollars. We don't have to print dollars.
Yeah.
And they don't have to print euros.
Right, because virtually all money is created as in the form of a loan anyway. So if you
That's
own
right.
the banks, you can expand the money supply by making a lot of loans. The only problem is leakage when people withdraw money and put it under the mattress or when they transfer it out of the country. So how do you impose capital controls to avoid
you wouldn't really need them if the government took over the banks, which are already broke. So the government already is a major owner of the bank. It just leaves the management in the hands of the oligarchs. In terms of the domestic euros, the Greeks have already been pulling out all their money from the banks in a domestic drain. Either they're holding euro notes, or as Jamie Galbraith pointed out to me, the Greeks in the last 6 months have been buying cars, consumer goods, even boats. And that if Greece went to the drachma, or had a crash, then the Greeks could at least sell these cars. They could drive them, you know, up to Albania and sell the cars there. Cars have a resale value. Boats have a resale value. So the Greeks had pretty much protected themselves against this. Capital controls could have been imposed by the banks in terms of large transfers of money abroad. But in terms of euros, the Greeks basically simply need enough euros and enough domestic currency to operate. And the capital controls would almost be imposed by Europe, the European Central Bank, by trying to freeze out the Greek banks.
Mm-hmm. Which they couldn't do if it was all digital. I mean, as long as they stay digital, right? They're dealing in checks and credit cards, and the ECB wouldn't be able to freeze them out. I mean, they can only freeze them out from printed euros. Right?
That's not the technicalities. There are not really my department, but I think that they weren't worried about that. They thought that they'd solved that problem. When you and I were in Malaysia, it was explained to us how Malaysia had solved that problem.
Yeah, I totally think they should go the way Malaysia went.
Yep.
Although that did get Malaysia in a fair amount of trouble, I think. But I mean, it worked.
Well, the trouble Malaysia had was not because of the capital controls. It was because of the Malaysian domestic political situation.
Right. It got them into political trouble. Yeah. Oh, very interesting. You had written about the German economic miracle and how it had followed massive debt forgiveness by the Allies, where they annulled all the domestic.
Yes, it's very
debt.
Curious that the discussion of this has not been taking place more. The Allied currency reform of 1948 abolished all domestic German debt, except for the payroll debts that employers owed their employees, and except for, you know, basic minimum working balances. And the reason that the Allies were able to do this is that most of the German debts back in 1947 and 48 were owed to the Nazis or the ex-Nazis. So they were basically canceling debts to people who they'd held responsible for the war. So Germany was freed from domestic debt, and that made it one of the lowest cost economies in the world. Then in 1953, Germany's foreign debt was written down, the debt that it owed ostensibly for reparations in World War I and others. So first, Germany's domestic debt was written down in a clean slate, the Allied monetary reform, and then the foreign debt was written down. And what they called the economic miracle wasn't really free markets. It was markets that were free of debt.
So that obviously worked brilliantly well, and the Germans saw it themselves. So why are they so resistant? I mean, I assume it's not the German people, it's someone else.
Yeah, they're pulling up the ladder. The beneficiaries have been the German banks, and the German banks mm-hmm. are as predatory as banks in other parts of the world. After World War II, the United States was very careful to put in the most right-wing people they could, just as Operation Paperclip brought most of the ex-Nazis to the United States. So the Americans backed the right-wingers in Germany as they backed the Yakuza and the right-wingers in Japan. And so Germany became an economy dominated by the banks that are extremely right-wing and followed the same logic that was used to extract German reparations against Germany in World War I.
And your latest book is called The Bubble and Beyond.
Yes, so, and I have another book that will come out next month called Killing the Host, How Finance Capitalism is Destroying Industrial Capitalism.
Oh, cool. I'll look for it.
Counterpunch will be publishing it.
Oh, cool. We're at the beyond, and we're it's looking kind of like a big abyss. So how do we get out of it? Not just Europe, but I mean in general. In the U.S., we're obviously doing
well,
better
than they are.
Well, the beyond
really turned out to be foreclosure time. In 2008, Obama had come to office promising that he was going to write down the bad mortgage debts to the amount that people could pay. But instead, he didn't write down the debts. Instead, he bailed out his campaign contributors, the major Wall Street bankers, and he put Wall Street lobbyists, such as Tim Geithner, in charge of the Treasury, essentially to double-cross all the people that had voted for him and to be Wall Street's candidate. How do we get out of it? There's no way that you can get out of the current malaise that we're in as long as you keep the debts on the books, and the debts were never written down. And nobody's really talking about the debt issue. I mean, you and I are talking about it, but the politicians aren't talking about it. It looks like things are just going to be a slow crash. Nothing fast, just a gradual slow crash, a tightening of living standards, raising charges on Americans, and a whole continued shift of wealth and income to the 1%.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the problem, that we write and we think we know the answer, but they own the media and they've got the power. How do we?
Well, we're in the same problem that Greece is in. That's exactly the problem there. The media are all owned by the oligarchs there. People believe, what's in the media. And fortunately, the internet gives you and me a chance to express ourselves, and we have. Interested people following us. But what we talk about is not in the economics curriculum that's even discussed in the schools. So apart from University of Missouri at Kansas City, maybe a few other places, hardly anybody's talking about the role of finance and how what people think is the American economy is really two economies. It's the finance and insurance and real estate sector, the rentier class, as opposed to the labor, and everybody's interest is all the same. And you really have a situation now where the interests of Wall Street are opposed to the rest of the economy, but Wall Street is the major funder of both political parties, both in the presidential campaign, in the court system, and in the media. So it's very hard to break through the idea that somehow if only the banks can now make more money, if only the Federal Reserve can create another $4 trillion in quantitative easing and give to the banks, that's going to somehow help the people instead of helping the banks.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me in some ways it's more difficult here in the U.S. because it's just not obvious the devastation that's been wrought on the poor, that most people drive around and see everything looking fine. They watch TV, which seems fine. Seems like we're prosperous, unless you really dig into what's happening and how people have been forced out of their property and now they're having to pay rents that they can't afford and so forth. But so maybe arguably we need a crisis like Greece. I mean, in some ways, maybe things are more promising there on the cutting edge where they're on the crisis edge where they have to do something. And maybe
all of Southern Europe is certainly watching the Greek crisis. And the interesting thing, though, is that who's protesting against this financial austerity? It's not the left wing. The social democratic parties in Europe are now, they would be called right wingers now. They're to the right wing of the Republican Party here. The Social Democratic Party of Greece under Papandreou were the ones who led the austerity movement. The French Socialist Party under Hollande is leading the austerity movement. The Socialist Party of Spain, right wing, leading the austerity movement. And they were the people who were taking the hard line towards Greece and saying, no, don't forgive any of its debts. The people who are opposing Europe are the right wing of all. In France, Marie Le Pen. In Italy, the right wing. In Hungary, the right wing. So it's the question is, why is only the right wing protesting against financial austerity? Why is the left wing, the Labour parties, the Tony Blair groups in England, or the Democratic Party here, which is what used to be called, if we were using the terminology of 20 years ago, the Democratic Party would be called right wing, and that's because it's become the austerity party too. Why is only the right wing complaining about this?
Mm-hmm. And that almost seems to be true here too, that it's the libertarian wing that talks about money reform, whereas the Democrats or the left isn't.
Yes, unfortunately, the libertarian reform tends to be gold bugs and wants to go back to even harder money that would make austerity even worse. So the problem is that when the right wing talks about monetary reform, it doesn't know what money is. And when you and I talk about it, we know that money is credit, and that you create money by creating a credit. Neither the right wing nor the left believe this. Paul Krugman says that it's impossible for banks to create credit. Mm-hmm. In his infamous debate with Steve Keen that everybody should read because it's so wonderfully humorous, where Steve was trying to explain that banks do create credit, and Paul Krugman said, no, banks just lend out savings. He thinks commercial banks are savings banks, and that's what he was taught in college, and that's basically why he got the Nobel Prize, for not understanding money. That's the precondition for getting the Nobel Prize. You have to, if you understand money, then you're disqualified.
I think that is the problem, that people don't understand banking. They don't understand that it's actually a factor in all this. They think that banks are just intermediaries. They take in money and then they lend it out, and that's not what they do, as the Bank of England just acknowledged recently. So maybe
the Bank of England has been doing wonderful material. IMF research director has been driving out anyone who's reasonable, anyone who doesn't believe that you should cut wages and you stabilize finances by austerity, is just fired. So they had one good guy that you and I have met often, Michael
Kumhoff,
and he left. He's happy with the Bank of England now. There are a lot of people there. Steve Keen went from Australia to London, and he's meets with the Bank of England occasionally. So the Bank of England is really taking the lead in popularizing what money really is and what credit really is, and trying to develop a credit system that it will use money to actually help the economy rather than act in a predatory way.
Thank you so much.
Great. It's good to talk to you, Ellen.
You too. I've been talking with Michael Hudson, Wall Street financial analyst, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of many books.
Listening to Michael Hudson and Ellen talk about how the monetary system is devised to shield Wall Street banks from debt and loss while forcing the public to swallow the losses, or as the phrase that you've heard before goes, privatize profits, socialize losses, I was struck last night when I read a powerful and comprehensive retrospective by two of Wall Street's most astute and credible critics, Pam and Russ Martins, who write a daily blog called Wall Street on Parade. As someone who apparently likes having your head into this sort of thing, I highly recommend their daily column to you as a source of academic-grade analysis and observations from their inside perch within that industry. The article I read, I'm going to share with you now. It's a few minutes long, but will remind you of where we are in this monetary shell game and who we're really dealing with when we talk about the system that controls every aspect of our lives and how it has crushed our democratic rights and prospects. One of the reasons I'm sharing this with you is the author's disbelief at how the news media, which itself is a corporate monopoly on information, hasn't discussed it. Here's their article, entitled, Why Wall Street is the Most Dangerous Example of Corporate Domination. It was published September 5, 2017 in Wall Street on Parade. As if someone had quietly turned on a light bulb last month, illuminating the corporate takeover of America. A series of articles from multiple outlets chronicled the demise of American democracy under the jackboot of the corporate state. David Dayan at the New Republic wrote, "Far from selfless arbiters of right and wrong, CEOs are as responsible as anyone in America for skyrocketing inequality, climate crises, waves of consumer fraud, and the biggest financial meltdown since the Depression. Condemning the unpopular views of an unpopular president whom they see as an inferior businessman is no sacrifice, especially when they're simultaneously plotting with administration officials to win as many perks as possible. CEOs aren't finding their voice. They're finding a way to control government like a marionette while hiding the strings." Last week, Don Kopf, writing for Quartz, provided more clarity. Citing newly released research, Kopf wrote, "According to economists Jan de Loker of Princeton University and Jan Eekhout of the University College of London, this basically describes the U.S. economy since 1980. In a recently released paper, de Loker and Eekhout analyzed the balance sheets of listed companies from 1950 to 2014. In 2014, these firms accounted for around 40% of all U.S. sales. They found that average markups, defined as the amount above cost at which a product is sold, has shot up since 1980, with the average markup being 18% in 1980 versus nearly 70% in 2014. And John Light of Moyers & Company wrote about the latest efforts to further pervert representative government through more unbridled corporate financing of political campaigns. Light explained that there are three riders deep inside the House Appropriations Bill that are intended to bar federal agencies from enforcing campaign finance laws. One insidious rider is aimed at a Federal Election Commission rule, says Light, and would allow every trade association under the sun to receive money from a given corporation during that year. Light explains, quote, "These trade associations are already powerful groups, some of which are well known publicly, such as the American Petroleum Institute or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Some of them are more obscure, like the Association for Christian Retail. But most exist to lobby for policies that would help their members' bottom lines, sometimes at the expense of workers, the economy, or the environment. If these riders pass the House, these groups will have a much larger war chest with which to punch their agendas through." Now, what is fascinating to us is that so few American journalists have adequately expanded on the seminal work of Senator Bernie Sanders to enlighten the public during last year's presidential primary race to the fact that Wall Street is to concentrated and perverted corporate power what Hurricane Harvey is to a water main break. No other industry in America even comes close. John Mann, a member of the British Parliament, encapsulated the point during a Treasury Select Committee hearing in February of 2014 when he rhetorically asked his colleagues, "Is there any other industry in recorded history in this country who's had a comparable level of quantifiable wrongdoing to your knowledge?" The same global banks, of course, that call the U.S. home also dot the skyline of the City of London, the UK's version of Wall Street. After Wall Street collapsed the U.S. economy and financial system back in 2008, for the second time in less than 100 years through its own unchecked greed and corruption, one would have expected Congress to have rolled out inviolate laws and safeguards. But nothing of the sort happened. The Occupy Wall Street slogan from the era accurately sums up the federal government's actions. Banks got bailed out, we got sold out. As a result of a Federal Reserve audit amendment that was tacked on to the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation back in 2010 by Senator Sanders, the public learned the following year from the GAO, the Government Accounting Office, that the Federal Reserve had secretly sluiced more than $16 trillion in almost zero-interest rate loans to Wall Street banks and their foreign peers, many of whom were counterparties to their insanely leveraged derivative trades. In January of this year, the GAO provided further research on the financial relief that was provided to real human beings in America. The GAO study showed that as of October 31, 2016, the government had disbursed $22.6 billion, or 60%, of the $37.51 billion in troubled asset relief program funds that were directed at helping distressed homeowners who were impacted by the 2008 Wall Street financial crash and the resulting housing bust. Now compare that miserly gesture of almost $23 billion to the $7.8 trillion in near-zero interest loans that the Federal Reserve secretly funneled to just four Wall Street banks from 2007 to 2010. They gave $2.5 trillion to Citicorp, $2 trillion to Morgan Stanley, $1.9 trillion to Merrill Lynch, and $1.3 trillion to Bank of America. Not only did Wall Street get bailed out and the public sold out, but its power became more concentrated as the most powerful banks were allowed to gobble up other collapsing big banks with financial assistance from the Federal Reserve. Not only did Wall Street get bailed out, but its titans never saw a day of jail time. No attempt at prosecution was even made. According to the PBS program Frontline, there was not even a pretense of investigating the head honchos on Wall Street by the U.S. Justice Department. There were no investigations going on. There were no subpoenas, no document reviews, no wiretaps. Equally outrageous, Wall Street was not only unrepentant, but its crimes grew ever more collusive after the bust. The big banks were repeatedly charged with coordinating the rigging of markets like the interest rate benchmark LIBOR and foreign currency exchange trading. One bank's serial conduct was so extreme that a pair of lawyers published a breathtaking book on the subject, comparing the bank to the Gambino crime family and explaining why the bank should be prosecuted under RICO statutes for serial frauds against the investing public. But instead of executives being prosecuted under RICO statutes on Wall Street, Congress continues to allow these mega banks with serial histories of crimes against the investing public to run their own private justice system. The courthouse doors, to this very day, remain closed to individual customers of the big Wall Street banks, as well as their employees who must sign away their Seventh Amendment right under the U.S. Constitution to access the nation's courts. Bob Urey, in a 2012 opinion piece at Counterpunch, sums up the U.S. model of faux democracy. He writes, quote, "The surveillance state, built at our expense, is the servant of the bankers and corporate leaders. The bankers and corporations are the state." Urey urges the public to recognize that the values that the bankers and corporations have handed us are not our values and are not even human values. Evidence actually exists to prove that the surveillance state, funded by the very taxpayers it targets, has now fused with Wall Street. The same firms under investigation in 50 states for mortgage and foreclosure fraud, and widely credited with causing the nation's economic collapse. The Wall Street firms that were involuntarily bailed out by the 99% are now policing the 99%. End quote. And that is the end of the article, called Wall Street is the most dangerous example of corporate domination. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.